Welcome to AAA Sky. Today we're discussing brown dwarfs and astrofashion with Dr. Emily Rice. I'm Irene Pease.
And I'm Stanley Fertig. AAA Sky is produced by the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York, whose mission is to promote the study of astronomy and to emphasize its cultural and inspirational value. Find out more about us at www.aaa.org.
First, a word from the president of AAA, Brian Berg.
Hello and welcome to episode 2 of AAA Sky, the official podcast of the Amateur Astronomers Association of New York. I am Brian Berg, president of the association. I hope that everybody enjoyed the first podcast. I certainly did. And in this edition, we will be talking to Dr. Emily Rice, who will be discussing brown dwarfs. And not just brown dwarfs, but what are brown dwarfs? Are they a star? Are they a planet? And whatever they are, what would they wear? Because as a sartorialist, Dr. Emily Rice thinks about these things. And Stan and Irene will be talking about what type of dress color should a brown dwarf wear? And not only the dress color, but what about life around a brown dwarf? Could there be life around one? These are the type of questions that we like to engage our listeners with. This is the mission of AAA. We want to get people thinking. We want to build a community around all things astronomical. I hope that you enjoy this ride with us of AAA Sky. And with that, Stan and Irene, take it away.
Emily Rice is an astronomy professor at Macaulay Honors College, CUNY. Her work primarily focuses on near-infrared spectra to characterize property of the low-mass objects in our galaxy. She's a founding member for the Brown Dwarfs in New York City Research Group, BDNYC, and a research associate for the American Museum of Natural History. In addition to her scientific contributions, she has become well-known for her astronomy-related public outreach projects. She's a co-founder of the astrocentric fashion blog Startorialist, a coordinator and host for the Astronomy on Tap series, and a parody video creator, and she served as a public presenter at the Hayden Planetarium. I got to speak with Emily about brown dwarfs and astronomy fashion via Zoom. So welcome, Emily, to AAA Sky. I'm so excited to be able to talk to you about brown dwarfs and other things today.
I'm excited to be here.
Great. So I guess just jumping right in, brown dwarfs, how would you describe brown dwarfs to people? What are they?
Brown dwarfs are still nicely difficult to describe. We still don't understand them, which I like to call job security. But we think that they're, so brown dwarfs are these weird objects that we think form like stars do, but don't quite have enough mass to fuse hydrogen into helium like stars do. So they don't become true stars like that. But they're still more massive, we think, than the typical planets, at least for the typical planets in our solar system. So there are these weird, sometimes people call them failed stars, but we don't like to think of them as failed stars because who wanted to be a star anyway?
Not me.
Yeah. And the neat thing, they've only been discovered for a few decades or so. They were kind of postulated to exist in the 1960s when stellar astrophysical theorists started to think about stellar structure and started to understand it and thought about what would these things be like if they were lower and lower and lower mass. And they realized that at a certain point, they wouldn't actually be able to fuse hydrogen into helium. They wouldn't have high enough temperatures and pressures at their cores. And so these things were predicted to exist in the early 1960s, but they weren't discovered really conclusively until the mid-1990s, which is not that long ago. And so we at first started studying them, kind of being interested about the low mass ends of star formation. How many of these things are there? What are their properties? Things like that. But now we're really interested in them, especially because it turns out that our solar system is very unusual. And there are lots and lots of other planets around other stars that are not really predicted based on what we would expect in our solar system. It turns out that there are planets around other stars that are much more massive than any of the planets in our own solar system. And it's really hard to study those planets because they're right up next to the star. And so we compare it to studying like a lightning bug next to a lighthouse. It's just a huge, huge contrast problem. But these brown dwarfs are like these lightning bugs, but out in the middle of nowhere with nothing bright around them whatsoever. And so we can study these objects and compare their cool atmospheres or outer layers to these giant planets around other stars. And we think that they're similar, and that can help us understand both of these types of objects.
So I'm going to make sure I've got some of this so far. So we have things that are bigger than Jupiter. So Jupiter is our largest planet. So things bigger than Jupiter, smaller than a star, not a failed star, because who wants to be a star anyway? But when you're talking about, like, I guess I have a couple questions about how we detect them. So you said it would be hard to detect something like this if it's too close to another like really, really bright star that's like blinding. But you can see them when they're just kind of off on their onesies, off on their own out in space. Are they bright enough to be detected with visible light? Like how do you detect them?
Yeah, that's part of the reason that they eluded us for so long is because they're not actually very bright in visible light. Because they're so low mass, they end up being very cool. And so most of the radiation that they emit is longer wavelengths than our eye can see. So they're very, very, very faint in the visible, but they kind of glow at longer wavelengths and at infrared wavelengths, near to even mid and longer wavelengths. And so it wasn't until we had really good infrared detecting technologies and even beyond the just the technology, we also had to have all sky surveys in order to find these things because we didn't know where to look. There wasn't any one particular reason why they should be in one place as opposed to anywhere else. We did start to look for them in kind of clusters, young clusters like the Orion Nebula cluster and Taurus and things like that. But because those are younger regions, finding brown dwarfs like that was a little bit of a gray area still. And so it wasn't until we really did all sky surveys in the late 90s and early 2000s in the infrared that we found a large enough number of brown dwarfs to kind of really solidify their existence and start to talk about them in terms of as a class of objects.
So when I think about all sky surveys, right, so we see, you know, more recent, the Gaia all sky survey, really gorgeous, the cosmic microwave background all sky that a lot of people may have seen. When you got this all sky survey in the infrared, like, were you mostly looking, you mentioned some clusters that you tried looking in, but maybe they were too young. Is it mostly along the Milky Way that we're finding brown dwarfs, or is it off the plate, or is it kind of all over?
It's away from the plane of the Milky Way, but not because they're not in the Milky Way galaxy. They're in the Milky Way galaxy, and in fact, they have to be pretty close to us. Because these things are so low mass, so cool, and so faint, we can't see them very far away, and so that means we see them all over the sky. And so it took these all sky surveys in the Milky Way galaxy, but we don't look for them really, really, really in the plane because then the field gets too crowded and there's just too many bright stars there. We can't see these faint things. And so we do look above and below the plane of the galaxy in order to find the objects, but they're so close by that they're still technically within the Milky Way galaxy.
And when you say close by, like what is close by? Like
really close. Yeah. These are things. So one of the all sky surveys actually was a space-based all sky survey called the WISE survey, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer. That was kind of a subsequent follow-up one after the ground-based surveys. That was a more recent one that's still ongoing to look for asteroids, interestingly enough. But that one could have potentially found a brown dwarf in between the solar system and Alpha Centauri, if it was there, in Proxima Centauri. So the supposition was that there could be something even closer to us than Alpha and Centauri, but just so cool that we weren't able to see it yet. That wasn't discovered, but there were a couple other objects that were discovered within still a few, you know, less than 10 light years away from Earth. I think the numbers are something like 6 and 7 light years or so. And so these things did change. You know, if you consider a brown dwarf a star-like object, which I think we should, then it changed the top 10 of closest star-like systems to the sun.
Who wants to be a star, really? Yeah,
exactly.
There could be some lot closer that we haven't even found because they're so faint. What are like the furthest ones that we've been able to detect? Like, I don't know, in these surveys, like in general, like how far out are we detecting them?
They go out to probably not much more than 100 light years or so, I'm going to guess. I don't know, actually, the really furthest away one. We could know about some that are really far away, but discovered not directly, but via microlensing. That's kind of an indirect way of discovering objects. And so it's a way of discovering things kind of pretty far away, because it doesn't necessarily depend on the distance to the objects, how easily we can see them. But the vast majority of brown dwarfs are, say, between 10 and 100 light years or so. And after that, they just get so faint that even with our best infrared telescopes, we get ratty data, basically. And so we don't look too much further than that.
So, and there's a lot, right? So, I mean, I used to tell people, you know, back in the 90s, like, oh yeah, our sun is kind of average, you know, kind of middle size. But if brown dwarfs decided they wanted to be stars, like then all of a sudden there's all these other things. Like, are they like outnumbering our like the other stars in the...
Yeah, it's kind of like, depending on where you draw the line, we think that, so that for stars, the lower mass the star is, the lower the mass the type of star is, maybe I should say, there's a lot more of them. And so the sun is definitely outnumbered by the very low mass stars. Those are like still proper stars. And then the brown dwarfs, we think there's about as many as there are of the low mass stars. The brown dwarfs are kind of a smaller range of masses, a smaller range of temperatures than those higher mass stars. And so it depends on really how you classify them, where you draw the line. But there's a lot of them out there. They're just so faint that they're really hard to see. And so they don't dominate our night sky or anything like that.
But if we could see in the infrared and we had really huge eyeballs, right?
Yeah, so we would have a really different sky. That would be so cool.
So we have to look at a different wavelength just to find these, to see these. You also mentioned something about learning about their atmospheres. Do we study their atmospheres the same way, or do we use a different detection method to try to figure out, like, learn more about what's in their atmosphere?
Yeah. So that's kind of what my research focused on, is I didn't necessarily discover these objects. I didn't even really start my career until they were after they were nicely discovered. But what I was really interested in is doing spectroscopy on these objects. And so taking spectra of these objects, taking their light, especially in the infrared, and spreading it out by wavelength to see what we could actually figure out about their properties. The spectra of the objects can tell us things like their temperature. It can tell us things about their surface gravity, which tells us about their size. It can tell us things about their composition in terms of what elements are in the atmospheres. And by atmospheres, like, there isn't really a solid surface. It's much more like a gas giant planet. And by atmospheres, I just mean really the outer layers that we can see and not necessarily anything above a solid surface, unfortunately. But we can figure out maybe even what the weather is like on these objects, like how, if there's clouds that are forming out of dust, for example, out of solid particles, if those clouds are changing with time. These all create signatures, different types of features in their spectra. And so that's what I like to try to figure out.
That's amazing. It boggles my mind that almost everything we know, like, we know so much about the universe beyond Earth, and it's almost all from light.
Yeah.
And we have like some sample return and stuff, but just the people like you, right? Exactly what you said, like figuring out, like, what can we even figure out? Like, how can we tease this information out of the light? So I don't know, is there anything else you want to talk about with your research, like any new detection methods or tricky techniques or computational methods that you really like that are maybe you can explain to our listeners?
I'm really excited about the launch of the James Webb Space Telescope. Like, this is the year, finally.
Is it going to happen this year?
I have not heard any rumblings of delays, which is, you know, even from up on high, and I have my ear to the ground. I like to know that I do hear about the rumors before they reach the public, and I have not heard anything, and I have asked. And so I might almost be ready to bet on that this is the launch year. And a lot of people think about James Webb as exploring like the really, really distant universe and going all the way back to what we call the dark ages before a lot of stars and galaxies turned on, and seeing as far back in time as a big telescope like this could see. But it's also going to do close by things. And so we do have groups of scientists that are going to use it to study planets around other stars and to study some of the really faint, cool brown dwarfs, because we've never had a telescope this powerful, and it will work in the infrared, which is really exciting for brown dwarf scientists in space before. And so it's just going to be phenomenal. And it's also so neat, like it's, you know, it's going further away than Hubble did. So instead of in low Earth orbit, it'll be at the second Lagrange point, about four times further away than the moon is. But because of that, it'll be able to observe the universe much more continuously. And so we'll have a lot more observing time on it than we do on the Hubble overall, even though it's, you know, it might not be as long of a mission. It's amazing that Hubble has lasted over 30 years already. And James Webb might last 5 or 10 is the nominal mission timeline. But the motto of NASA is under promise, over deliver. And so hopefully we, except for maybe the deadlines and the budgets, but in terms of the mission performance. So hopefully we'll have a lot of James Webb data coming for years to come.
That sounds great. Yeah, I know. Hubble definitely over, I feel like Hubble overperformed once they got the glasses on it, the rovers.
Cassini, everything's gets wonderful mission extensions. Juno. Or just got a mission extension.
Wait, which one did?
Juno.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, everybody forgets about, I really thought Juno was going to be super hype after Cassini, but, and it comes back with beautiful, beautiful data, but this next mission extension is going to give us more flybys of the moons, some of the Galilean moons, which I think will be really exciting. And so maybe Juno will move up there in terms of the famous space missions.
Just a sidebar. I am teaching a class about current missions. So yes, everyone in my class is learning all about Juno. They learned about L2 last week because we have stuff there already.
Awesome.
Rosita, blah, blah, blah. yeah. Back to the brown dwarfs. I guess one other question I had just about, and maybe this isn't the area that you're researching, but are there also brown dwarfs in multiple star systems? Because I know like a lot of like, you know, sun-like stars are in multiple star systems. So our sun is still kind of unique being, you know, all on its onesies. But do we detect them now around other stars?
Yeah. Is that a big thing? Yeah. Oh, yes. So there's definitely brown dwarfs in binary systems. And that's really handy because that's really one of the only ways that you can get a true dynamical mass, like a mass just based on Kepler's laws, is when you have a brown dwarf binary orbiting one another. So it's not directly my research, but like one of my close collaborators in grad school, one of my classmates in grad school started out doing brown dwarf binaries. And actually her research advisor, she's Quinn Konopacki, and she's a professor at UC San Diego. Her advisor is famous not for the brown dwarf binary research, but for supermassive black hole research. And her name is Andrea Ghez. Yeah. And so
I heard that name before.
Yeah, exactly. The recent Nobel Prize winner. We were so thrilled. And so Andrea, like, because it's an orbit problem, really. And so it doesn't matter whether it's a star around a supermassive black hole or whether it's brown dwarfs orbiting one another. It's the same techniques that she really pioneered that you can apply to both of those problems. So those brown dwarf binaries are super useful. Yeah.
So being able to detect the masses, and then do those translate? Like, because I think you mentioned being able to estimate. Did you mention you were able to estimate mass like from the atmospheres?
Yeah, you can try. But if you use the atmospheric properties and you try to estimate a mass, then you're relying on a bunch of models. So things like structure models, evolution models. And really what you want to do is test it and see if you get the same answer from all different techniques. And so one of the things that we do, for example, is take the dynamical masses that we get from orbits and compare it from the mass predictions that we get from other observed properties, temperature and brightness and things like that, and see if those masses match. And they don't generally, which is another job security issue. Yeah. And we're also running up against issues. Goodness. Like you'd think we've had these things, you know, it's already been a few decades, but there's also issues recently where even trying to get the mass of like a single object, the really cool objects are turning out to be really, really massive, like almost massive enough to technically be stars. It's at the mass boundary based on the internal physics is something like 75 Jupiter masses or so. We think that above 75 Jupiter masses, an object should be able to fuse hydrogen into helium. And below that, it shouldn't be able to. And there's also different classes of brown dwarfs based on their temperatures. And so we've been measuring the masses of some of the cooler types of brown dwarfs that are called T dwarfs, one of the extensions of the OBAFGKMLTY spectral classes is this T dwarf spectral class. And a bunch of them are coming out way too massive, way more massive than we would expect. And so we haven't fully reconciled this. The first one, it was like, okay, maybe it's a mistake. Maybe there's some kind of distance calibration issue or something like that. But the numbers of too massive brown dwarfs are starting to build up. And so we're having a little bit of tension there that we're going to have to figure out at some point.
It's good to have job security.
Yeah, exactly. The mysteries of the universe will keep us employed. Yeah. And then we try to figure out, so there's also brown dwarfs that orbit other stars, but where do you, like, how massive does that object have to be before you call it a brown dwarf and not a planet is an open question. Or even if you have one brown dwarf and a smaller brown dwarf around it, maybe the main brown dwarf is like something like 25 Jupiter masses, and then the companion is something like 5 Jupiter masses. Is that a planetary system? Is that a brown dwarf binary? Like, what do you call it is really an open question. And so we're still trying to kind of find and classify these things in order to figure out how we should even organize them and how we should even define them. It's the stamp collecting again.
So some mass issues, one being able to have models that agree. So always, of course, important to like that your models agree. And then also just trying to define your limit. So 75 Jupiter mass is kind of the upper limit, and then the lower limit kind of question.
Yeah, we don't know. There's a technical lower limit that's about 13 Jupiter masses that's defined by not hydrogen burning, which is the upper limit, but by deuterium burning, so heavy hydrogen burning. And initially we thought, okay, maybe that's a good boundary between planets and brown dwarfs. But it turns out that it's not, because it doesn't really mean anything. Like the hydrogen burning limit really changes the evolution of the object over time, because whether or not you can fuse hydrogen really is a game changer. For deuterium, though, it's a very low abundance isotope. And so there's not much of it. Even if you are able to fuse it, it doesn't really change the evolution of the object. It's just like a little bit of a flicker. It's like maybe an engine turning over and that's it. And so it turns out that the kind of overall properties of the object don't really care about this deuterium fusion. And it also seems that the nature, the universe can form things out on their own that are lower than this deuterium fusion limit, maybe even down to 10 or 5 Jupiter masses. And it will also form things around other stars higher than that deuterium burning limit. And so we have to kind of figure out a better way to distinguish between these objects. And I do think it ends up being formation, which is where I usually put in a Beyonce reference when I'm doing a presentation.
All the gifts in the...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you, Beyonce, for that. She's so great. So speaking of like mysteries of the universe, diversity of the universe,
stars,
and pop culture, you're also known for another project. I know you do a lot of science outreach, a lot of astronomy outreach with the public. And one of the things you do is host, you are a co-founder and host the site store Startorialist. Do you want to just tell us a bit about
that?
So maybe we can pick up on some fashion if anyone needs a t-shirt or some earrings or a baby bib.
Yeah, you know? We have so much. It's been so fun. So this is a project that I started back in 2013 with my co-founder, Summer Ash, who at the time was director of outreach at Columbia University Astronomy. And we were doing all sorts of outreach events at the Museum of Natural History and with Astronomy on Tap, which had formed just earlier in that year. And we realized that we were both wearing all kinds of astronomy themed clothing to do our outreach. And we were like, this is awesome. Isn't it great that we can buy all these things? There was leggings with galaxy prints on them and star print shirts and things like that. But we both, you know, lived in New York, had small closets and saw it as a really great opportunity for doing outreach and explaining to people like what's the science behind these clothes that are available. Cause sometimes it would be real images, you know, from the Hubble Space Telescope or real astronomical objects. And we were like, this is a great teaching opportunity. And so we decided instead of buying everything and keeping it in our closets, that we would curate a blog. And so we would find things available online or take pictures of people on the street and post them on this blog. And so we started brainstorming around the middle of 2013. And then we launched everything kind of in the fall of 2013. And we have a big annual astronomy research conference every year in January. We just had our virtual one for the first time this past week. And so we kind of launched the first blog at that meeting 7 years ago, taking pictures of our colleagues. Like, we weren't the first to do it. We just started, we were the first to really notice it and start to curate and share it. And it's really, we thought a little bit that it would be a fashion trend that would just die down, this, you know, change the way the fashion trends tend to change. And it didn't. And it kept going.
it just snowballed. Yeah.
And we even, so this research conference is about scientific results generally, but there's always education and public outreach sections where you can present projects that you do, classes, innovations, things like that. And so the following year after we launched it, we presented it as a poster to talk about the outreach that we did. And to talk about why we thought it was important, why we thought it was useful, what kind of things we had found. And the number one frequently asked question that we got from other scientists coming up to the poster was, where do I buy this stuff? You know, I want to buy presents. I want to wear this stuff for myself. And that was like a little bit unexpected, honestly. And so 2 years of that, presenting two different posters. Then somebody from the conference actually said, you can sell stuff at the conference, because they had sold stuff right before. They had invited, you know, designers, and they had people selling t-shirts and stuff like that. I, in fact, myself had bought a solar system necklace before I finished my PhD at one of these conferences. And so we were like, okay, like in the meantime, through the blog and through finding these things and writing posts about different things that we found, we had gotten to know a lot of small designers. So people that they had their own Etsy shops and people that made their own things. And so we kind of pooled our resources and said, we'll have a showcase booth at one of the conferences. This was in 2017. And so we had a showcase booth where we had things on display that were made by a lot of these businesses. And then we had discount codes set up so that our colleagues could then go buy things on their own after the conference.
So they didn't have to keep asking you, where can I buy stuff? Question answered. Yes. You're welcome, scientists.
Except that, you know, it turns out you can lead a horse to water, but, you know, they still want you to help them drink a little bit. And so, it turned out it was good, but it wasn't kind of as huge as we expected. It was the type of thing where, you know, you go to a conference or you go to an event like this, you meet a lot of people, you come home with a pocket full of business cards, and then you flop down on your couch and stare at the ceiling for a few days and forget everything. And so the next year after that, another colleague of mine had started up a consulting company. And these are all like astronomers doing other things, on the side for fun. And she had started up a consulting company. And she said, well, you know, I've already incorporated. I have my accounts and everything set up. I can just apply through this business for a wholesale retail license, you know, tax exemption, all kinds of things. And we can buy stuff wholesale and sell stuff at the conference. And so we did that for the first time in 2018. And that was also just amazing. Like, the one mistake that we made was not buying enough stuff to bring with us. We sold out of almost everything that we had that first conference. And so that was really, really exciting. And to be able to directly, you know, purchase from the designers that we had gotten to know and love, and then sell them to the astronomers that then got to, you know, wear things that they were very excited about that involved their research somehow, and then even help connect the two and help artists kind of get direct information and kind of help the artists get direct inspiration from the scientists and kind of vice versa was just amazing. And so now we've been doing that at pretty much every major astronomy conference, which is at least every 6 months. We've been setting up, we call it a boothique, in the exhibit halls of these conferences, and we really become well known, which is really, really fun. And I even joke about the fact that, like, because we kind of expected this being a trend to die, the way that you might think the expansion of the universe would slow down by the overwhelming force of gravity. But it didn't. And part of the reason that it didn't is because we were there kind of connecting artists and designers and scientists and collaborating with people and inspiring new designs. And so I joke that we are the dark energy in this sartorial fashion universe, and, you know, commissioning new designs and working with missions and institutions and observatories and scientists to kind of share their science in this really fun way has just been an amazing and unexpectedly successful project over the last several years.
I just love that the astronomy trends in fashion that I, you know, saw a few years ago. I was like really excited. It's like, yeah, because there was just an astronomy thing that happened in the sky. People get excited. But to see it continuing and to know that there's a driving force. So thank you. First of
that's
all,
a great I know I've gotten some things on the story
list. Yeah, it's just great. And it's great to know that like, if I want to do an outreach thing and there's like something really specific, if I really want to dress up, I can, because there's Star Tourist.
Oh, yeah.
And there's like something for everything.
We've got, you know, like so many themes. We also, my favorite part of the shop, I think, is shop by science. So we have a menu that's organized, you know, we have the menu organized by clothing, jewelry, accessories, things like that. But we might be the only, one of the only fashion shops, online shops that has things organized by astronomical object. So all of the planets, you know, constellations.
Go to your favorite planet.
Yes, solar eclipse, a lunar eclipse, stars, galaxies, the universe as a whole, like, you know, black holes. We've got everything there. It's just, it's such a wonderful mix of art and design and science.
We'll definitely have that linked in our show notes. So anyone who's interested in Star Toilet, any astronomy fashion, please check that out.
Ooh,
visit the shop.
Maybe we can even set you up with a definitely. Discount.
Maybe
we can do that.
We will talk about a discount code.
Awesome.
We might get that for our members.
Oh, yeah.
That'd be awesome.
We can absolutely do that.
I'd appreciate that. Well, it's been so great at astronomy, fashion, and masses of the universe, everything with you, Emily. One last question that we like to ask all of our guests. You've lived in New York. You've lived in a couple boroughs
yeah,
in New York, if I'm not mistaken.
Three now.
So, New York City, what is like one must see or must do thing in New York City? Like what's your favorite like New York City thing?
Mm.
It doesn't have to be astronomy related. I know there's other things in the universe.
Right now it's playgrounds. Yeah. Right now for me, it's playgrounds, especially like I have two young kids, you know, the museums are open again, but you know, the playgrounds are fantastic. And so exploring the city and exploring the outdoor spaces like that are really, really fun.
Do your kids have a favorite playground?
I don't know. I think any of them that I'll take them to is really their favorite. Yeah, really
the playground of the day, that's your
sometimes
favorite.
Even the tiniest ones are the most fun if we get them all to ourselves one day or something like that. I would love to have a space themed playground. Actually, there's the one in Queens.
By the New York Hall.
Yeah, there's the putt-putt. There's a miniature golf, the science themed miniature golf, which my kids are not quite old enough yet. to go to. And then they do have, what's it called? It's like the physics. There is kind of a physics themed playground and it's got an enormous slide that my, like at the time, I think he might've been 2-year-old, like threw himself down because he just loves slides so much.
Just testing physics, right? There's a lot of like every amusement park is a giant physics playground
it
for grownups.
Is, yeah. Momentum and angular velocity and acceleration due to gravity. Absolutely.
So much acceleration. Well, thank you so much, Emily. Really appreciate you taking the time from all of your projects to chat with us. And we'll be seeing you out there. We'll know you when we see all the astronomy fashion walking towards us.
I can't wait to get back out there. Good to see you. Good to talk with you.
So you spoke both about brown dwarfs and Sartorialist fashion, and to put them together, I saw Emily speak at Columbia a few years ago, and she was wearing a dress with what looked like a purple Jupiter print. But it wasn't Jupiter, that was a brown dwarf. Apparently one of the classes of brown dwarfs is supposed to be purple in color.
That's interesting. And I feel like I've seen that dress, but it's kind of odd that it would be purple because I would think it would be on the other end of the spectrum, like purples towards the ultraviolet as opposed to red would be more towards the infrared.
You would think. I was wondering, listening to you, whether brown dwarfs can have moons going around them or planets.
Yeah, well, I guess depending on are we classifying them as planets versus stars, which kind of goes back to it was interesting. She mentioned like the formation could be the main source of, you know, trying to draw a line, you know, put a line in the sand or along the spectrum to differentiate. But yeah, I mean, certainly it seems like they should be able to have non-stellar satellites or some kind of non-stellar companions.
So here's my question. If there were, I'm going to call it a moon. If there were a moon going around a brown dwarf with a nice elliptical orbit, maybe the brown dwarf's gravity could create a subterranean ocean on that moon, similar to what's going on at Europa and Enceladus in our solar system. So it's not impossible to imagine that there could be life on an exomoon going around a brown dwarf. How wild is that?
Brown dwarfs with their own little critters. That'd be something.
So as we know, small, relatively cool red dwarf stars make up more than half of the stars in the universe. So she said that there are just as many brown dwarfs out there in all likelihood as there are red dwarfs, which would mean that more than two-thirds of the star-like objects in the universe are either red or brown dwarfs. So the moral of the story would be the universe is cool.
I thought you were going to say the moral would be there's lots of potential for life out there. But yeah, also cool. I'd go so far as to say cold, maybe about 2.73 Kelvin. So bundle up out there, folks.
And now here's Irene's celestial forecast.
Thanks, Danley. For daytime astronomy, we have the waning moon. It's a little more challenging to find while the sun is still out, but fun to follow and handy for tracking those tides in case you're planning a beach day. Currently full and setting at dawn, it will thin through this part of its cycle as it drifts east and sets later in the day. By March 9th and 10th, we'll have an old crescent moon joining a trio of planets in the dawn sky, Mercury, Jupiter, and Saturn, with Jupiter appearing the brightest and Mercury the dimmest of the three. On March 5th, Jupiter and Mercury will appear less than a degree apart. Catch the conjunction before 6 a.m. close to the east-southeast horizon. Venus is also rising in the morning, but it's in the glare of the sun for now and will reappear in the evening sky in late April. As mentioned in our previous episode, our first featured constellations are themed around the first point of Aries, which is currently in the constellation Pisces, which you can't really see this time of year, partly because the sun appears in that part of the sky and also because it's a faint constellation. If you look just above the western horizon around 7 p.m., you'll notice a relatively blank part of the sky, which actually has several faint stars outlining the two fishes of Pisces. In a very dark sky, you might spot the star Alrysia, designated Alpha Piscium, although it's not the first but the fifth brightest star in Pisces. Alrysia is also seen as the knot connecting the two tied fish, perhaps a celestial reminder that sometimes small things can bring us together. That's your celestial forecast for now. But speaking of small things that can bring us together, like astronomy and fashion, thanks to our friends at Startorialist, right now our listeners can use the code AAASKY, that's AAASKY, to get 10% off an entire order at startorialist.com. It's one discount per customer. You can enter the code at checkout or use the link shop.startorialist.com/discount/AAASKY.
And that's our show. Tune in next time when we discuss the history of the telescope with AAA Executive Vice President Bart Fried. Until then, stop by AAA.org to learn more about the AAA and how you can become part of it.
AAA Sky audio editing and original music is by Preston Staley. Our technical producer is Parker Bossier.